everybody. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Indirect Democracy. This week on Indirect Democracy, I'll be talking about the President's State of the Union Address, plus the March on Washington. Also, there'll be a global warming update, a new sponsor, and the What a Weenie Award. And welcome! Welcome to podcast number 20 of Indirect Democracy, found at www.indirectdemocracy.com. I am your host, my name is David, and Indirect Democracy, as always, is a very proud member of the Progressive Podcast Network. You can find that site at www.progressivepodcastnetwork.org, or their forum sites and their blog site at newmediarevolutionaries.com. I always encourage you to go visit their sites and be part of their network. Take time to listen to all of the greats or any of those wonderful people who put out some terrific podcasts there at the Progressive Podcast Network. I also want to thank everybody extend my thanks to everybody that's been adding their dots onto the Frapper map at the homepage for indirectdemocracy.com. If you may have noticed, and this is no requirement on your part, this is only if you wanted to, little by little I noticed that some of the dots are leaving. I don't know if that's a temporary thing with the Frapper map, if that just goes and comes, if it's anonymous and you just leave it. If you want to register, fine. You know, that's totally up to you. I just appreciate you being there. If you want to check on it every now and then just to make sure that your city is still up there or your spot's still up there and you want to repost, that's great. It's totally up to you. But to those of you who have and are still doing so, thank you for putting it there. And as always, I am waving hi. Especially to the people in London. I saw London hit and went to school in London for a little while, and a little special place in my heart right there for the wonderful city of London, England. But I am glad to be back. We have a lot to talk about this week. There's a lot that's going on. But as always, we're going to start with the global warming update. And this one is from CNN.com, and it's called Smoking Gun Report to Say Global Warming Here. And here's the story. Human-caused global warming is here, visible in the air, water, and melting ice, and is destined to get much worse in the future, an authoritative global scientific report will warn next week. The smoking gun is definitely lying on the table as we speak, said top U.S. climate scientist Jerry Mulliman, who reviewed all 1,600 pages of the first segment of a giant four-part report. The evidence is compelling. Andrew Weaver, a Canadian climate scientist and study co-author, went even further. This isn't a smoking gun. Climate is a battalion of intergalactic smoking missiles. This particular segment, written by more than 600 scientists and reviewed by another 600 experts and edited by bureaucrats from 154 countries, includes a significantly expanded discussion of observation on the climate. That report will feature an explosion of new data on observations of current global warming, Solomon said. The full report will be issued in four phases over the year, as was the case with the latest IPCC report issued in 2001. Global warming is happening now. It's very obvious, said Mulliman, a former director of NOAA's Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Lab. When you look at the temperature of the Earth, it's pretty much a no-brainer. The February report will have much stronger evidence now of human actions on the change in climate that's taken place. The world's global average temperature has risen about 1.2 degrees Fahrenheit from 1901 to 2005. The two warmest years on record for the world were 2005 and 1998. Last year was the hottest year on record for the United States. Ice sheets in Greenland in the past couple years have shown a dramatic melting, and sea levels are rising and doing so at a faster rate in the past decade. Also, the second part of the International Climate Panel's report to be released in April will for the first time feature a blockbuster chapter on how global warming is changing health, species, engineering, and food production, said NASA scientist Cynthia Rosenzweig, author of that chapter. As confident as scientists are about the global warming effects that have already documented, they're as gloomy about the future and even hotter weather and higher sea level rises. Predictions for the future of global warming in the report are based on 19 computer models, about twice as many as in the past. The future is bleak, quoted one scientist. Now, as always, when giving you the global warming update, I'm aware of how overwhelming the news and evidence can be. And I don't mean to give you that to bring you down. I present you with this news with the hope that little by little it can be part of what causes you to change the habits that you live with, and also to present that to other people to cause them to change their habits. We've talked about, you know, recycling, and that one can at a time can hopefully make the change. Well, it has to go beyond just you and just yourself. It has to go to family, friends, coworkers, to educate them little by little. Make these changes, because together as a group, as a collective, we can start to make little differences in how we affect our carbon footprint. And one other thing, as if we're going to mention different things to bring about the discussion of how to bring about positive change for the planet, just because it's now big news and it's the type of thing that people should also talk about, An Inconvenient Truth, and I know I talk about this movie a lot, was recently nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. Just because it's that time of the season, people do get a little bit excited about movies that are up for awards, at least especially here in the Los Angeles region. You know, talk to your friends, convince them, rent them the movie, buy them the movie. Just convince them to get the word out, so this way you can say, hey, it's up for Best Documentary, and maybe share that with them as well. Share the song I Need to Wake Up by Melissa Etheridge, which has also been nominated for an Academy Award. But find positive ways to present this information, because I know that the news is bleak, but there are ways that we can start to change it, and hopefully, I know there are lots of things that we cannot reverse, damage that has already been done, but maybe we can start to reduce future effects, because it is a very important issue for us to be involved with. And speaking of important pieces of information and ways that you get information from about global warming and how to treat the planet, I would like to give a special thank you to AJ, who put out My Green Promise, which put out its final episode for the Progressive Podcast Network on January 23rd. Wanted to say to AJ, thank you, and for all your hard work. Please believe that it did not go unappreciated, and I'm sorry that it's over, but every little thing counts, AJ, if you're listening. I hope that you know that you made a difference for one person. Now, usually after the global warming updates, I usually give out the president's horoscope. I'm going to skip it this week, because when I gave it last week, it pretty much encompassed all of this week. So the ones that are up from Elle Magazine still go to last week. So there's not going to be a presidential horoscope for this week, but there will be one for the next podcast. And if you look forward to that, I apologize. If you would like to find out what it was, or if you're interested in looking, you can always go to Elle.com and look at their horoscopes just for fun. But I do have a few ads that have to be played for this episode of Indirect Democracy. And this past week, I was contacted by my local cable company. They heard last week's public service announcement with the local Cub Scout troop, Troop 420. And they seemed excited about being involved. So here is, from my local cable company, the first of this week's newest ads.
This week on E! Entertainment TV, Dr. 90210 gets a visit from the Bush administration.
Hello, handsome. I see from your file you're looking for a troop augmentation.
I'm trying to get my troop force and approvals up.
Well, let's see what we have to work with.
Oh no. Well, that's kind of saggy.
Will Dr. Ray be able to make this augmentation work, or is this plan doomed from the start? Tune in to Dr. 90210, only on E! Check your local listings for showtimes in your area.
Okay, one of the things I wanted to talk with you real quickly about is the situation with WIRN. Now, as I talk to you about this, the World Internet Radio Network, I usually do plug the World Internet Radio Network in as many of the past, since podcast number 10, of the podcast for Indirect Democracy. I did not for last week, and there was a reason. In my discussions with WIRN, it was going to be my understanding that Indirect Democracy would be placed at Sundays at 6 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Eastern. And was looking forward to that because I felt that would be a good time for people to catch up on some political news for an independent radio network. For reasons that I'm unaware of, or maybe just because of their choice, I don't know if they just didn't care for the direction indirect democracy was going in, or maybe just a decision on their own. But they have not been playing this podcast during that time slot. So I don't know what's going to happen with them, but to WIRN, I would like to say thank you for taking time to play some of these podcasts over your radio station. I did appreciate it. I did have a lot of fun with it. I don't know if it's going to continue in the future. If they like to and they want to, I think it is important to get as many progressive voices out there as possible. I'll be talking about media in just a little bit, but it's for that very reason that I believe it's important that we try to get progressive voices out there. So if you believe or know of anyone who has a voice, some new ideas that have to be gotten out there, have them contact WIRN. Maybe they're the voice that that radio station needs. But I do thank them for giving this podcast some airplay, and look forward in the future for finding other avenues in which to get this message out. In 2004, many people talked about the vote in Ohio, how the vote had been rigged. And everybody, when you talk to them about what happened in Ohio, their first discussion with you is, oh, you're a nut, you're a conspiracist, I can't believe you buy that. Well, to all the right-wingers listening and to anybody you know who doesn't buy into that, here's a news story. It's from the Associated Press. Ohio poll workers convicted. Two election workers were convicted Wednesday of rigging a recount of the 2004 presidential election to avoid a more thorough review in Ohio's most populous county. Jacqueline Maiden, elections coordinator of the Cuyahoga County Elections Board, and ballot manager Kathleen Dreamer were each convicted of a felony count of negligent misconduct by an elections employee. They were also convicted of one misdemeanor count each of failure to perform their duty as election employees. Now, although nobody is ever going to know the full impact of what they did, it is now fact that people have been convicted of their role in the 2004 elections in Ohio. This is no longer conspiracy theory. It's the type of things that they like to claim is a left-wing nut job type of thought process. No, this is now criminal fact. So if anyone that you know says, hey, let it go, nothing happened in 2004, you can say yes. Not only did something happen, but there have been criminal convictions to back it up. So you can put that one in your pipe and try to vote on it. Okay, one of the big news stories, of course the biggest news story of this past week, was the President's State of the Union address. And from the beginning, you had to have some type of disappointment with the way that the subject of Iraq was handled. In fact, it was pretty much left towards the end, the final half of the speech. It's the thing that you needed to talk about first. It's what people wanted to hear. It's what affected the election. Iraq, as I have said, is the seminal issue of our time. And for the president to bury it in the State of the Union address went to show what he truly believes. Now, maybe it was done that way to deal with timing issues, maybe to have the big punch. You always want to have a good closing. In some aspects, as they say in entertainment circles, it's good to leave them wanting more. I don't know if that was necessary in this case. It really is the important thing that needed to be talked about right then, right there, because all domestic issues based on spending come from Iraq and everything that we have mortgaged in this war. What was primarily disappointing about it, and specifically when we're talking about Iraq, is the discussions of how much was put into it in the realm of Iran. Now, since his big speech at the beginning of the year, everybody has been focused on the fact that he is probably leaning towards a war with Iran. This should be no surprise to most people. If you just look at the most recent news events that have occurred, an admiral has been put in charge of Central Command. Two carrier groups are headed towards the Persian Gulf, if are already in the Persian Gulf, and these carrier groups that are there have Patriot missiles. Now, the last time I heard, unless insurgents and rebels and terrorists got their hands on some type of ballistic missile technology and are going to start striking us with missiles and not IEDs, for what reason would carriers have Patriot missile defense systems? Well, they wouldn't unless they were about to be attacked by a country with a larger coastline and missile technology, you know, let's say, for instance, Iran. Now, the president came out recently and said that U.S. troops are now allowed to protect themselves from the Iranians. In a quote to the Washington Press that was reported, U.S. forces have the authority to capture or kill Iranian agents that are believed to be attacking American soldiers inside Iraq. Now, of course, this story takes on many interesting levels because of what the president is claiming. First, he's claiming, of course, that Iran is behind the funding of the Shia extremists. Also, this also has a varied level because of the president's claim that Iran is interested in a nuclear weapons technology and not nuclear energy. Well, we're going to handle that issue first and get through it really, really quickly. If you would like to hear some interesting news or a recap, go back to podcast, I believe it's podcast number 8, which deals about the possible upcoming war with Iran. I talk about the Scott Ritter interview and go over some other issues that came up, and it talks about where Iran stands technologically, politically, so you can get a better concept and idea. But in a quick nutshell, the nuclear energy program that they're trying to get has been something that the United States has been trying to put forward in Iran since the 70s. It was Dick Cheney that first tried to introduce a nuclear energy program into Iran back in the 70s because the Iranians believed that they would not have enough fuel to last them through this century. And in fact, the Iranians primarily just do one thing, they export oil. And sooner or later, any country, if that's all you have, you're going to need another energy base. And it's something that we try to convince them to get back in the 70s, and we're doing so up until the fall of the Shah of Iran. So just understand that history point when you think about Iran's so-called search for nuclear weapon technology. There's more that goes into it. Please take the time, if you want, if you can, listen to podcast number 8 of Indirect Democracy, because it really goes into political information about Ahmadinejad and his role. That's the first thing. The second thing is dealing with Iran and how they're financing or dealing with the Shia interests in Iraq. Now, this story comes from the Washington Post, and here it is. The title of it is British Find No Evidence of Arms Traffic from Iran. This is from October of 2006. On the Iraq-Iran border, since late August, British commandos in the deserts of far southeastern Iraq have been testing one of the most serious charges leveled by the United States against Iran, that Iran is secretly supplying weapons, parts, funding, and training for attacks on U.S.-led forces in Iraq. A few hundred British troops living out of nothing more than their cut-down Land Rovers and light-armored vehicles have taken to the desert in the start of what British officers said would be months of patrols aimed at finding the illicit weapons trafficking from Iran, or any sign of it. There's just one thing. I suspect there's nothing out there, quotes Lieutenant Colonel David LeBoucher, speaking at an overnight camp near the border, and I intend to prove it. Other senior British military leaders spoke as explicitly in interviews over the past 2 months. Britain, whose forces have had responsibility for security in southeastern Iraq since the war began, has found nothing to support the Americans' contention that Iran is providing weapons and training in Iraq, according to several senior military officials. Quote, I have not myself seen any evidence, and I don't think any evidence exists, of government-supported or instigated, end quote, armed support on Iran's part in Iraq. British Defense Secretary Des Brown said in an interview in Baghdad, it's a question of intelligence versus evidence. Brigadier James Everett of Britain's 20th Armored Brigade said last month at his base in the southern region's capital, Basra, one hears word of mouth, but one has to see it with one's own eyes. These are serious consequences, aren't they? They are. Allegations that Iran or its agents are providing military support for Iraqi Shiite Muslim militias and other armed groups is one of the most contentious issues raising tensions between Washington and Tehran. Most gravely, U.S. generals and diplomats accuse Iran of providing infrared triggers for special explosives that are capable of piercing heavy armor. Evidence of Iranian armed intervention in Iraq is irrefutable, according to one U.S. commander in Iraq, Brigadier General Michael Barbero, who explained this to reporters in August. The lead U.S. military spokesman in Iraq renews the allegation almost weekly in Baghdad. Iraq's remote Maysan province is a funnel for Iranian munitions, said Wayne White, who led the State Department's Iraq intelligence team during the war and is now an adjunct scholar at the Washington-based Middle East Institute. White said that in the first year of the occupation, a well-placed friend had seen considerable physical evidence of it, and just about everyone in Al-Amara knew about it. I'm going to get into an interesting story regarding Wayne White in just a little bit, but I want to continue with the story. But Major Dominic Roberts of the Queen's Dragoons said, we have found no credible evidence to suggest there is weapons smuggling across the border. asked why he could declare himself so confident that no arms were coming through, Labouchere mildly cited his confidence in Iraq's border force. Guards at one of the 27 border forts now used to guard Maysan were dismissive of talk of military support from Iran. It's just fabrication. To determine the truth of these charges, British commanders say the British troops did something no other large-scale conventional unit in the U.S.-led coalition here has tried. They gave up their base. Almost every night for 4 months, rockets and mortars had pounded Abu Naji, the outpost where British forces had made their home outside of Amara, Maysan's provincial capital. In the base's last 5 months of use, 281 rockets or mortar rounds hit Abu Naji. So the British forces packed up. The night before they left, mortars gave Abu Naji a farewell pounding. When the British troops pulled out that afternoon, the mobs moved in. Iraqi forces briefly tried to hold back the crowds, then gave way. This is the first Iraqi city that has kicked out the occupier, loudspeakers at the local offices of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr trumpeted. If trouble in most of Iraq had inevitably followed foreign soldiers, the soldiers in Maysan didn't seem to hear anything coming. Attackers had lobbed a rocket or mortar round at them during the first week in the desert, but there had been nothing since. At the least, Labouchere said, "I am satisfied our presence will reduce the dangers for the rest of Iraq." Ultimately, however, the British can do little more than demonstrate that the borders are closed. Save for that, he said, they find themselves trying to prove a negative. So this is an interesting story on several parts, because one, here are British soldiers and officials within that region saying they have found no credible evidence to show that the Iranians are supplying anything, or at least much of anything at all, to the Shiite militia forces, which goes in contradiction to what the president is now claiming. And here's an example where British forces pull out of an area, allow it to be left to the hands of the Iraqis to make up their own lives, and afterwards, even though the Iraqis went in and took over that base, after that, there was little or no trouble that came from that region. And of course, the story also takes on a different turn when it comes back to the subject of Wayne White. And I bring him up because there is an interesting story that has come out recently regarding Mr. White. And this is the story. It's called U.S. Plans Envision Broad Attack on Iran. U.S. contingency planning for military action against Iran's nuclear program goes beyond limited strikes and would unleash a war against the country, a former U.S. intelligence analyst said on Friday. "I've seen some of the planning. You're not talking about a surgical strike," said Wayne White, who was a top military analyst for the state's Bureau of Intelligence and Research until March of 2005. "You're talking about a war against Iran that would likely destabilize the Middle East for years. We're not talking just about surgical strikes against an array of targets inside Iran. We're talking about clearing priority targets by taking out much of the Iranian Air Force, Kilo submarines, anti-ship missiles that could target commercial ships and warships in the Gulf, and maybe even Iran's ballistic missile capability." That's very interesting when we think about the type of carriers that are on their way to Iran, ones that have Patriot missile defenses on them. President Bush, of course, has stressed that he's seeking a diplomatic solution to the dispute. The Bush administration and many of its Gulf allies have expressed growing concern about Iran's rising influence and the prospect of it acquiring a nuclear weapon. Tehran's leaders have convinced many experts Iran is a great nation verging on superpower status, but the country appears weak and meets almost no known criteria to be considered a great nation, says one expert from the Congressional Research Service. The economy is mismanaged and quite primitive, exporting almost nothing except oil. Also, Iran's oil production capacity is fast declining, and in terms of conventional military power, Iran is a virtual non-threat. The wheels are being turned in the same fashion that they were back in Iraq. This is, for lack of a better term, a very poor sequel of what we have experienced already. The plans are out there. The pieces are in play. And the rhetoric to get people fired up is being said. It is time not to buy that and wake up to what is being presented to us. This president intends to go to war in Iran, and we have to make sure that if he does this, he will not do this with the people's support, and that our legislators know that we do not support this war because we realized that the evidence to it is wrong and that we are about to be lied into another conflict. So that was part one of what I found very interesting about the State of the Union. Here's part two. The one thing that I think is just a travesty upon this country, and one of the things that is possibly the second biggest issue, and I don't mean to degrade it in any way, shape, or form, especially to people who are living or who were forced out of the Gulf Coast region. Katrina is a national disgrace on levels that we have never experienced before. But nobody talks about it because it is the one issue we like to forget about because nobody deals with it. And apparently, to add on to that, neither does our president. In a time when an entire section of this country, including a major city, was pretty much leveled and destroyed, our president, even though the work is not done in the Gulf Coast region, chose not to address the problems of Katrina. Due to his failure to discuss the aspects of what happened in Katrina, I felt it was important to share as many different news stories as I could about what is currently happening in the Gulf Coast region and, of course, particularly New Orleans. Now, this is not meant to slight people that live outside of the New Orleans region, but since New Orleans basically is like a beacon for what happened on that terrible week back in 2005, a lot of these stories will deal with New Orleans. And as I said, it's not meant to take away from the recovery efforts that are happening outside of that region, but it is meant to put a sharp light onto what is not occurring and what is occurring within that region. So, here are some of the news stories that are coming out of the Gulf Coast region. This story is entitled New Orleans Looks Behind State of the Union Snub. It was from the LA Times. Unfazed, Mayor Ray Nagin kicks off a 2-year loan program. Mayor Ray Nagin is way beyond caring whether President Bush mentioned New Orleans in the State of the Union address. We're 18 months into this thing, and I'm tired of complaining and belly aching. Nagin was unfazed. We're going to take whatever nickels we have, whatever pennies we have, whatever dollars we have, and we're going to stretch it, and we're going to make this recovery work. The mayor made his remarks as he announced a 2-year pilot program that would offer loans interest-free for 6 months. Almost 101,700 families have applied to this program, but as of Monday, money had only been made available to 258 families. City officials and residents are frustrated by the slow pace many homeowners doubt they will ever receive, wrote Home Assistance. Also Wednesday, other Louisiana lawmakers introduced a bill that would allow the federal government to forgive loans made to local governments after disasters. I guess the pain of the hurricane is yesterday's news in Washington, said Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco. But for us, it's very real, and it's something that we live with every single day. Some critics have blamed Blanco's administration for the slow disbursement of the road home money. Nagin's Gap Loan Program, which is funded by $11 million in federal grants and will be administered by Chase and Liberty Banks, will initially allow up to 1,000 homeowners who lived in New Orleans Parish when Katrina hit to borrow up to $50,000 interest-free for 6 months. The fund would be gradually replenished as homeowners received road home grants and paid off their loans, according to Nagin. In another story dealing with the lack of response to the president and his State of Union to Katrina, here are some quotes. In the president's State of the Union speech last year, delivered just 5 months after the disaster, the devastation merited only 156 words out of more than 5,400. On Tuesday night, the president spoke for almost exactly as long before a joint session of Congress, but Katrina received not a single mention. At this time, I almost broke my TV, knocked it off the stand, according to one resident of New Orleans. People were already feeling forgotten. I think this may potentially reinforce that. Officials in New Orleans were also disappointed by the oversight. The governor is supremely disappointed. The president's speech was promoted as focusing on his domestic priorities, yet we see where hurricane recovery is on his list. It's not even on the radar. Republican Senator David Vitter's criticism was more muted. I was disappointed somewhat, Vitter said, but I didn't necessarily expect a significant mention primarily because the federal government has provided a great deal of funding and aid and because most of the hurdles we face are at the state level. By contrast, in the days ahead of the president's address, Democratic Senator Jim Webb of Virginia compared the U.S. money being spent on Iraqi reconstruction with the fraction committed to the Gulf Coast rebuilding, and chosen to give the Democratic response to Mr. Bush on Tuesday, Webb brought up the continuing struggle of Katrina's victims right away. listing Restoring the Vitality of New Orleans just behind Education and Healthcare. In a story from BBC News, storm victims feel anger and neglect. 1 year after Hurricane Katrina, many people in the small Mississippi town of Waveland feel cheated. Others feel neglected. Cheated because insurance companies have only paid out for wind damage, not water damage. Neglected because New Orleans, about 60 miles away, continues to dominate media attention. Some hurricane survivors in Waveland say the famous city known as the Big Easy has been given more recovery money from the federal government. The people of Waveland lived through a catastrophic event. Locals say winds of 140 miles an hour battered the seaside town, sending a 35-foot surge of water up the main street. Businesses and homes were wiped out. In one instance, a homeowner in Waveland says her property was insured for $89,000, yet she was only paid $10,000 for wind damage because the company did not pay for water damage. In a story related to that, State Farm has agreed to pay Katrina claims. State Farm and Casualty Company agreed Tuesday to settle hundreds of lawsuits by policyholders and reopen and pay thousands of other disputed claims, a landmark deal potentially worth hundreds of millions of dollars for Mississippi homeowners devastated by Katrina. The settlement calls for State Farm to pay about $80 million to more than 600 policyholders who sued the company for refusing to cover damage from the August 29, 2005 storm. State Farm also agreed to pay at least $50 million, but possibly hundreds of millions more, to thousands of Mississippi policyholders whose claims were denied but didn't sue the company. And in recent news, to add on to that, the judge that was overlooking that settlement denied to sign on to the settlement. This in a region that is still trying to recover from devastation on a level many of us pray we will never imagine. To add on to the despair that is occurring in that region, New Orleans is starting to suffer from a major crime wave. But for many residents, the rash of murders has been one of the last straws in the recovery of Katrina. And here are some audio clips from ABC News Nightline to give some examples of what is occurring in New Orleans.
City officials promised to put more cops back on the beat, establish late-night checkpoints, and add surveillance cameras. But the murders have some New Orleans residents second-guessing their decisions to return.
For the first time, I just felt like, why do I live here? You know, why did they live here? And I just really felt like things are just never going to change here. We're stuck in this rut, and it killed my friend.
If everybody leaves, if everybody, all the artists leave, you know, it's like then with one bullet, you know, that person's been able to take away everything that's good about the city.
To combat the rise in crime, here's some information from the Department of Justice Law Enforcement regarding their efforts in New Orleans. According to this source regarding funding, the Department of Justice has made nearly $30 million in grants available to the City of New Orleans and Orleans Parish to help rebuild the criminal justice system. In total, the department has made available to the state of Louisiana over $61 million in justice assistance grants and Katrina Relief Law Enforcement Infrastructure Funds. The FBI will detail an additional 9 agents to the New Orleans area to supplement the 13 FBI agents permanently assigned to the Violent Gang Safe Streets Task Force. In addition to the FBI agents, the task force is staffed with officers from area police departments and the sheriff's offices and focuses on the most violent subjects, whether associated with an organized gang or working in a more loose-knit fashion with other subjects. So those are some of the stats coming from our own Department of Justice. And the numbers that are glaring when you think about them are the $30 million in grants. Now, that's wonderful that our government is giving money and grants to help rebuild the local law enforcement offices in that area and providing more staffing. But when you think about it, 9 FBI agents, $30 million. Now put those numbers together to what we're trying to do in Iraq. How do you do that? How do you explain to American citizens, especially from the Gulf Coast, that our money, our men, our chances to possibly protect and rebuild the Gulf Coast are being sent overseas and being primarily given to contractors? How do you do that? How do you explain to Americans here who are suffering, watching families be murdered, watching homes not be rebuilt? How do you explain to people who can never go home or now want to leave their homes because of the government's neglect. How do you explain that money that could be going to the Gulf Coast is instead being sent to Iraq? I know there's a larger global struggle that we all talk about and that we all believe is what is necessary to protect this country. But somewhere along the line, isn't it necessary to also protect what is here at home? That somewhere deep down inside, we need to protect an artistic and cultural base? That somewhere deep down inside, we need to protect Americans who do not have a home? How do you explain to somebody that there is no money because that money is being spent on a cause that is failing? The president at one point spoke of the fact that our Congress did not vote for failure. And he's right. At that point, he is actually correct. Nobody wanted to vote for failure. But failure is what he has given us. It is time to put our money and efforts back to taking care of our country. It is time to put it back to making sure that people who lost everything can at least get back their right to live in their own home again. It is time to make sure that a major Gulf port and cultural center of this country, that a major American city that was destroyed, can be brought back to life again. That should be a major effort of this president's domestic policy, but it was not. The president chose to spend his time lightly brushing over domestic issues which he has talked about before, and only with the most lightest and broadest of brush strokes, with almost nothing to show in specificity for planning or how things would be paid for. Now that's of no surprise for any State of the Union address. Almost all of them are like that. But somewhere along the line, if you're going to talk about domestic issues, you have to talk about what happened in Katrina. That should be issue number one for any domestic policy by any president. And it wasn't even on the list of things that he talked about. So, as always, it's time to kind of pay the bills here. So, on a different topic and to get a little bit lighter, here is the second ad from our newest sponsor.
This week on Court TV, witness the high drama of the trial of former Vice Presidential Chief of Staff I. Lewis Scooter Libby. Can Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald get the Vice President to crack under examination?
Did you order the code red?
You don't have to answer that question.
I'll answer the question. You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's gonna do it? You? You, Lieutenant Weinberg? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago and you curse the Marines. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know. That Santiago's death, while tragic, probably saved lives. And my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. We use words like honor, code, loyalty. We use these words as the backbone of a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I would rather you just said thank you and went on your way. Otherwise, I suggest you pick up a weapon and stand a post. Either way, I don't give a damn what you think you are entitled to.
Did you order the code red?
I did the job.
Did you order the code red?
You're goddamn right I did!
Check your local listings for showtimes in your area.
Getting back to Katrina real quickly, one of the stories I came across, and I don't get a chance to go over every story that I found, and I apologize for that. That's why I try to get as many up on the research links as possible. One of the stories was the need for more school teachers to come down and be part of rebuilding the education program in the New Orleans area, and also the call for people who, if they're going to spend their spring break, why not go to the Gulf Coast region and help people rebuild. If you like, you can find those stories and read them on the research links for podcast number 20. They're great stories. Please take the time to read them. And if you cannot take the time to possibly go down there during your spring break, of course, you know, it's very hard for a lot of people, especially when you're not in college anymore. I encourage you very strongly. There is a link on the favorite links section for Indirect Democracy to Habitat for Humanity and the American Red Cross. Please make any type of donation you can to help out these great organizations who are dedicated to giving back to those who have lost everything. But going to the next domestic issue, which was brought up, the one that caught my attention the most of his issues, was the president's healthcare program. The president talked about a program to essentially allow for deductions in health insurance. Now, this is a big issue, of course, because of how important healthcare and insurance in particular plays to are the rising costs and everything from jobs, inflation. Many of the worker strikes that you see nowadays deal with the cost of healthcare. Now, I found this article from the Los Angeles Times called Health Proposal Gives and Takes. According to the president's plan, premiums to pay for job-based medical insurance, by far the most common source of health care coverage, are not treated as taxable income. Employer-sponsored health insurance has been a tax-free benefit for most of the last half century. But under Bush's plan, that tax exemption would be eliminated. Premiums for workers' health insurance, the amount paid by the employer plus any share paid by the worker, would be added to their taxable income. Then, deductions up to $15,000 for families and $7,500 for individuals would be provided to cover the premiums for workers with typical plans. With this proposal, more than 100 million men, women, and children who are now covered by employer-provided health insurance will benefit from lower tax bills, according to the president's State of the Union address. But the plan, according to the Los Angeles Times, would also raise taxes for 30 million people, and with health insurance premiums steadily rising, the initial tax savings could disappear for many middle-class workers as the cost of their coverage rose above these caps. According to one person interviewed for this article, a father of four who has worked for 7 years on the maintenance staff of a cement company, he earns about $55,000 a year and has employer-sponsored health insurance, worth about $8,400 a year, for which he pays about $57 a month. Projections show he would save about $1,500 in annual taxes under this new plan. But this employee, who voted for Bush, worries that his tax savings will evaporate as health care costs rise. He claims, and his statement is that I would rather be on my plan now and pay the $57 a month and not get the tax break. And this is a middle-class worker. But going back to the story, some experts said that this person's fears were not groundless. Though Bush proposed indexing the deductions to inflation, healthcare costs have grown faster than the overall inflation rate of 2.5%. Health insurance costs rose by about 6% last year. At the outset, only about 20 to 25% of insurance plans would be above the deduction threshold, but in the following 10 years as premium costs increase, 40% of plans would face additional taxes. The Bush proposal appears to have two goals: to encourage the uninsured to get coverage by reducing their out-of-pocket costs, and to encourage workers with insurance to switch from high premium coverage to bare-bones plans and rely on personal savings to cover more of their health care costs. To encourage savings, the president again pitched an expansion of government-subsidized health savings accounts, which he is most in favor of. According to reports, and this is also from the Los Angeles Times article, an estimated 47 million people in the United States have no health insurance. Some experts said Bush's incentives may be too weak and complicated to produce a significant reduction in the ranks of the uninsured. Workers with employer plans that cost more than the caps would pay taxes on the difference. That would increase taxes for employees who have better than average benefits, but also for some older and sicker workers who must pay more for even moderate coverage. Health status will determine whether or not you are above or below the cap. Healthy people will be able to buy below the cap, whereas less healthy people will get stuck buying plans above the cap. The younger people are going to benefit, and the older people are going to have problems. Under Bush's proposal, as of January 1, 2009, the total premium for a health worker's insurance would be added to the income line on the W-2 form, subject to payroll and income taxes. Then workers could take the new deductions. For instance, a worker earning $90,000 with what Bush considers a gold-plated $20,000 employer-sponsored family health insurance policy would pay $1,250 more in income taxes until switching to a less costly plan. The paper goes and lists the pros and cons, the pros being that everybody who buys health insurance would get the same tax break. Employees would learn their true cost of their insurance. Employees could reduce their taxes by switching to a lower cost health plan, and cost-conscious decisions by employees could curb health expenses over time. The cons are that the new deduction would be indexed to general inflation and not to the growth of health care rates. Premiums could be higher for older workers than those in poor health, exposing them to paying these taxes. And the new deduction would not go far in parts of the country where premiums are higher, and low-income workers get less benefit from a deduction. Automatically, just by hearing that, this is from the Los Angeles Times, you have to say that, again, this is a plan and a benefit meant to help out the wealthy. This is a plan that, for its status of terms, encourages people to get less coverage, to try to have them figure out what type of coverage is unnecessary. And that's the type of thing that you shouldn't put or ask people to decide based on trying to save money or get a deduction what health care they think is going to be unnecessary. Because if people could decide what they believe or think they think is unnecessary, then we could predict the future as to what is going to happen to us. Under a bare bones plan, of course, I would be protected from the most extreme of emergencies. But if I was to take away part of a plan because I felt it was unnecessary, what happens to me? What happens to my family? If one day that unnecessary disease, the one that nobody thought was going to happen, happens, the concept of Murphy's Law plays greatly in your mind, doesn't it? The president's plan asks people to play Russian roulette with their health. The other thing that's sad when you think about this is that this plan would get rid of flexible savings accounts. People who at their work have an account which set aside money for them to use before taxes so they can have it around for quick emergencies, whether it pay for everything from, you know, buying cold medicine to having prescriptions paid for when you go to a doctor's office because you have that money set aside before taxes. But that'll be eliminated because the president believes that people will automatically take that money and set it aside in these subsidized health savings accounts. The problem with that is the problem that occurs every day for everybody in the middle class. How do you set aside enough money to try to take care of these emergencies when many of us are just trying to get by paycheck to paycheck and live? The old thought that many people are essentially a paycheck or two away from bankruptcy looms large when you think about what the president is asking of us. Well, getting away from the topic of the State of the Union, I think that'll pretty much be the last of those things that I'll cover, except for when I get towards the end. This past week, I was introduced to a news story via Democracy Now! From January 25th, 2007, regarding the state of media-owned control over radio stations in a town in North Dakota that had had a train derailment that caused an ammonia spill. Now, I'm going to play for you some of the clips from that and the 911 calls and the responses and reactions from the townspeople and the 911 center that occurred. In fact, here are some of those clips.
This Clear Channel-owned station was the town's designated local emergency broadcaster.
911 emergency.
I called a while ago about a power outage and ammonia smell.
Well, you just need to stay in your house with the doors and windows closed until we direct you differently.
Well, how would we find out?
We will get that out on cable TV or the KCJB radio.
Because our electricity's out, so we can't get TV.
Okay. What about a radio?
Well, we have a little transistor.
Okay. One. That would be the thing to use then.
But what channel?
KCJB 910.
910?
Yes.
910. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, try that thing.
Hello? 911 emergency.
Well, I'm wondering about this anhydrous.
Sir, you stay in your home. Treat it like smoke. Turn your furnace off. Put towels underneath the doors. Go in your bathroom. Turn the shower on and cover your face with wet towels.
Okay.
And stay there until further instructions by law enforcement.
Okay, because the PA system doesn't work and it's...
I understand that. And also, we've been putting it on over the cable TV and the radio.
What's the radio station?
All the radio stations, sir.
I have had it on. I haven't heard it once.
When residents of Minot, North Dakota tuned in to KCJB, there was no emergency information about the chemical spill.
The danger of that story is the danger that is occurring with corporate-owned media throughout this entire country. Radio and TV serve more than a function than just to entertain. Radio and television also serve a public service. In this instance, that public service was denied to the town of Minot, North Dakota, when this train derailment occurred because the six owned radio stations within that area, including the one that was mentioned in the 911 operator's request, all owned by Clear Channel, did not have any local staff ready to take or initiate the emergency operation systems necessary within that region for what had occurred. The 911 operator unfortunately told people to tune to a station that was going to tell them nothing. It is time to get local control and ownership of radio stations back to the municipalities for which they are in. We talk all the time about how corporate-owned media has kept news stories from us. Well, beyond keeping even larger and broader news stories from us, there is also a lack of responsibility that occurs when a corporate-owned radio station does not provide, and even a corporate-owned TV station does not provide, the proper emergency services for which we grant them control, lest we forget that it is our government that grants control of the airwaves to these companies. News takes on a different function for us. The media and news services take on a different function because, as mentioned before and mentioned by other people, the press is considered the unofficial fourth branch of government, and it takes on a much more important role. So, when you can, where you can, hold your newspaper to task. If they are not giving you the news that you feel you deserve, then write to them. If your local television station is not giving you the news that you feel is more important, stop watching, or write to them and let them know you feel it's time for other news stories. And when it comes down to larger corporate interests buying out media ownership, it is time to get involved and say to your congressperson that you want local control back. And now an ad from the Progressive Podcast Network.
The anti-Bush press makes
their interests are not your interests. Their truth is not your truth. The corporations have their media. Now we have ours. The Progressive Podcast Network. Now we are the media. Listen to your media. Take your country back. Go to progressivepodcastnetwork.org. The Progressive Podcast Network. ProgressivePodcastNetwork.org.
Okay, now this portion of the broadcast is going to be different in that I'm coming to you now live from downtown Los Angeles at the March Against the War in Iraq. It is January 27th, and a very large group of protesters has assembled here in the streets of Los Angeles to protest the war and the president's policies. Marching in front of me amongst the crowd is Cindy Sheehan. Sheehan lost her son, Casey, in April of 2004. The crowd, which extends at least four or five city blocks, is a lot larger than past protests in this region. And for myself, I have to admit, this is a great thing to see in the streets of Los Angeles, and can't even imagine what it's like in Washington, D.C.
in addition to trying to get some of the speeches that will be given out, hopefully one by Ms. Sheehan herself, at the federal building here in downtown Los Angeles, I'm going to do my best to try to convince some people to be interviewed for this podcast to get their reactions, their beliefs, and why they are here on this day to protest the war in Iraq. Now, immediately, I'm going to apologize for the quality of some of these pictures. I'm using a tiny little camera that I don't want to possibly lose, the only good camera I own. And I apologize for that, not getting into that best part of the story. However, I am trying to get some of these photos of some of these plaques. Some of my favorites are Like a Rock, Only Dumber, with a picture of the president next to it. No More Cash equals No More Caskets. And, of course, War is Not the Answer. Here from just beyond the border of Broadway and First, in front of the Los Angeles Times building, the extent of the crowd still marches back several city blocks as they make their way towards the federal building in Los Angeles. Somewhere along the line, I know I've said this before, but there's something about even just seeing her for a brief second, in seeing Cindy Sheehan, you realized that, although not totally responsible, how large a part she played and getting this active movement going. In August of 2005, the president and the poll numbers showed every support they could get. A Republican majority gave him all the backing he needed, including a lack of oversight. However, one woman in a lawn chair stood out and said, "No, say to me, what is the noble cause for this war?" From that time, from Katrina on, the poll numbers have slipped and the people have come out. No greater example than the site being seen today in downtown Los Angeles.
We're recording.
What's your name? What brings you here?
My name is Philip Cass. I'm from Santa Monica. And this is my daughter Bailey, and I wanted to expose her to a protest against something that we think is not good for the country.
It's Bailey, right? Hi, Bailey. Do you have anything you'd like to say?
No.
Okay.
So we're against the war, and we just want to be part of the numbers to show President Bush that he's making the wrong choice.
Amongst the stands that are here in front of the federal building here in downtown Los Angeles includes one stand where Carolyn Ho will speak in Los Angeles February 3rd and 4th at the corner of 2nd and San Pedro Street. Carolyn Ho is the son of Lieutenant Aaron Watada, the first commissioned officer to refuse service in the Iraq War, and is currently on trial for those charges. And for the first time at a protest I've been to in a while, the stands which are set out for people who are running for president, including one stand for Representative Dennis Kucinich in his bid for the nomination for the presidency to the United States.
This is another event that we are standing up against the current regime.
Sure, here you go.
And March 17th is actually organized by Answer Coalition. And the event's going to be in San Francisco, Chicago, D.C., and Los Angeles.
And if you'd like to get a message out today, what would you like to say that's most important to you?
The occupation must end, not just in Iraq, but in Palestine, Philippines, Haiti, and the rest of the world.
One of the few things that you never get to see about Cindy Sheehan is that tattooed on her ankle is the word Casey, 7904. Of course, being the years that he lived, 1979 to 2004.
Freeze in Los Angeles and join their voices. Congress saying, now is the time to stop the funding, now is the time to bring the troops home now, now is the time to end the war. My name is Lisa Lubo, I'm with the Glendale Peace Vigil. I have been active all my life, and never before have I seen so many different groups in Southern California get together, work together, create an event like this, create the January 27th coalition, and put on a march to raise the voices of Los Angeles against this war. And I am so jazzed about all of you coming out today. This is the beginning of a new era. 85% of the people in this country a Democrat or Republican, but they are continuing to talk about escalating both funding and troops. It is up to us.
I agree.
It is up to us as the people of this country to remind them that they are our servants, that they are supposed to be obeying the will of the people. This is the will of the people. You are the will of the people. This is what democracy looks like. To start us off today, I am very happy to announce that we have Tom Morello performing as the night watchman. You may know he is formerly of Rage Against the Machine. He is currently the lead guitarist in Autoslave. He is the co-founder of Axes of Justice. He is the co-host of Axes of Justice Radio Network. And by the way, you can find all that at axesofjustice.org. And he has a show on music and politics and ears on Friday nights on our own public radio station, KPFK 90.7 FM.
David here. I'm with
Jeff Keys.
Jeff, where are you from?
Alabama. I live in LA now.
Now, you served in Iraq?
Yes, in 2003.
Okay.
In the Marine Corps.
Just one tour or more?
One tour.
How long were you there for? Q2?
I was there a little over 2 months. I came home for non-combat surgery and began to speak out against the war at the time.
Now, a the most important thing you'd want to say today? What would be the one thing you'd like to say about the protest and what you believe in today? It's a very broad question, I know.
It is a broad question, but a good one. I guess the simplest thing I could say is that if you truly believe in the security of our nation, if you believe in supporting what's best for the Iraqis, and if you believe in supporting the troops, then you'll oppose this war.
My name is Jumbo Bacalani. I am the vice chair of the California Democratic Party for President Congress, and we're here to struggle to make a demand. Frederick Douglass was right then, and he's right now. Power concedes to nothing without a demand. Never has and never will. We are demanding that the U.S. government, George Bush and his cronies, release, free, leave Iraq, leave Iran. No occupation, not tomorrow, now. Leave now. Power to the people. We stand. Next, we bring up. Thanks for the move.
It's really heartening for me to see so many people that agree with me. Let me tell you a little bit about myself. As he said, I'm Jason Lemieux. I'm a veteran of the United States Marine Corps. I spent 4 years and 10 months in the infantry, and during that time I served 3 deployments to Iraq. I participated in the initial invasion, and then I moved with my unit to Karbala, which is a Shiite holy city. My second and third deployments were in Sunni areas in Husseiba and Ramadi, the two of the most violent cities in all of Iraq. During my time in Iraq, I handed out soccer balls to little kids. I ate chicken at local restaurants. I was in 12-hour firefights, and I watched IEDs explode in front of my face, and I've seen my fellow Marines die. For those that are in the military, one of the biggest obstacles to coming out and opposing the war is that you face a lot of animosity from fellow service members, some of whom have a psychological need to believe in what they're doing. They have a need to believe that what they are doing is for a reason, and that their friends are not dying for no reason. And I'm not blaming them for that. I'm not blaming them for having this need. I'm just trying to explain to you why you keep hearing them calling up talk radio shows and saying, the media is only reporting the bad things that we're doing. They're not, what about the school that I painted? Well, the answer to that question is the school that you painted is strategically meaningless. It sucks, and it's hard to hear, but that doesn't make it any less true. Because the children of the school that was painted are the children whose fathers and brothers and uncles and sometimes sisters and sometimes them themselves are the ones that are being killed every day in Iraq. Because of the situation that's developed in Iraq, our troops are forced to use deadly force to keep the population at a distance from themselves because of the risk of suicide bombers. They're under strict orders. If any vehicle or if any person crosses a certain trigger line, if you tell them to stop and they don't stop, you shoot to kill. And it doesn't matter if there's a family of five in that car, they're going to die. What their commanders are not telling the troops is that every time you kill a family of five like that inside of a car, you create 100 new insurgents that are there to defend their family's honor. Iraq is a tribal society that has very strict rules of honor. And what frustrates me more than anything else is that some people just don't seem to understand that whether or not deadly force is justified in our eyes is not relevant to them. It's not relevant to this fight, whether or not you're shooting a guy because he was trying to kill you. As far as his family is concerned, you're the enemy now. They don't call the cops when something goes wrong. They won't feel any sympathy for someone who has killed a member of their family. You kill them, you just started a blood feud. And every time you kill one person, you create 3 new insurgents. So it is mathematically impossible to win by killing. Please understand, I'm not trying to assign a moral value to anybody on either side. I'm not trying to blame our troops for trying to defend themselves because of the situation that they were forced into. And I'm not trying to blame the Iraqi people for participating in what is thousands of years of established culture. I'm just here to tell you that is the way it is. It's not going to change. There is no amount of democracy or liberation that can change thousands of years of culture. And that is why we cannot win in Iraq. We cannot win now. We cannot win ever. We never could. It doesn't matter if we send 21,000 troops or 21 million. There is no military solution in Iraq because killing there equals losing. And the 18-year-old kids with rifles have been trained to do nothing but kill. They have been given no other tools whatsoever with which to win this thing. Unfortunately, I don't have enough time to list for you all of the reasons why this war is wrong, why it's an outrage. I don't have time to list all of the reasons why every single word that has come out of the president's mouth on this issue is absolutely ridiculous. But I do have time to tell you. That's because all of you have the courage to come out here and show your faces is the reason that we're going to make a difference. Congress is poised to pass a non-binding resolution opposing the president's troop surge. And some people have said that they feel that a non-binding resolution is worthless. It doesn't really represent any progress. But I think if you take a step back and you look at the past couple of years, you think in 2004 or 2005, Congress would have ever entertained the idea of a non-binding resolution against the president's use of force in Iraq? No, of course not. The mood is changing there, and it's not because our senators and our congressmen woke up one day and realized that escalating in Iraq is the wrong answer. It's because you're telling them. You're telling them, if you represent me, you're going to bring this thing to an end, because it's not working. It's over. We lost. And it's time to bring the troops home before more of them are killed.
Later turned himself in.
might be 18 when he is released. This war needs to end. All wars need to end.
Now, I know, I imagine that a lot of people know or do not know the name of Ron Kovic, but Ron Kovic was the inspiration behind the movie Born on the 4th of July, just a one-man struggle to help bring about the end of the Vietnam War.
Government will tell them exactly where the power lies. The power lies in the people and the citizens of this country. And that's what democracy looks like. This is what democracy is. You are part of a democratic movement in this country. Not only is this an anti-war movement, this is a democratic movement like Eastern Europe, like South Africa, like the Philippines. It can happen in America. It's going to happen here. We're going to change this country. We're going to do it dignified, nonviolently, in the spirit of Dr. Martin Luther King, in the spirit of Gandhi, in the spirit of Nelson Mandela. We shall overcome. We will change this country. Now is the moment. It's one of the most crucial turning points in the history of this country. Never before has a generation been given such an opportunity as all of you have been given now. We're sensing it with inside of ourselves. Something is terribly wrong, but with every danger there is opportunity. And we sense opportunity. We sense strength. We sense hope. This is the beginning. I believe in you. I love you. You are brave and courageous. This is just the beginning. You are good and decent Americans, and you will take this country back. You will find the courage to do that. This is your moment in history. This is your moment in history. Stop this war and change this country forever. God bless America. Thank you for coming today. Thank you so much.
Dignity in relation to their different faiths.
Admittedly, as the time goes forward, the amount of people that are here due to the rain and the cold weather is starting to dwindle just a little. But the voices that are being heard today are overwhelming.
To the degree that we assume the
between 5,000 to 10,000 march today in L.A. In Washington, D.C., 100,000 march. People across the country are making their demands known that they want to end to this illegal occupation of Iraq and not to attack Iran. Thank you. Let's bring up our next speaker. Let's bring up who are familiar with her. She got some kind words to say to you. And for those of you who disagree, she got some truth to tell to you, but you don't get it either way. Cindy Sheehan, anti-war activist, whose son Casey Sheehan was killed in Sadr City, Baghdad, on April 4, 2004, during a tour of Iraq. Co-founder of Gold Star Family for Peace. She'll track attention by camping out at the Bush compound. Note I said compound, not ranch. Her new book, Peace Mom, Mother's Journey Through Heartache to Activism, charts that repays growth as a mother and activist. This book is a celebration of Casey's extraordinary life. She writes in the foreword, this book is also an odyssey of one mom's journey from a place of pure pain to one of pain that is also infused with joy, hope. This is my story of how one person can, should, and must make a difference. Let's give it up for Cindy Sheehan.
You all looked marching today. When we got to the top of the hill and Ron Kovic and I turned back and saw all your beautiful faces and all the beautiful signs and all these people, all you guys, congratulate yourselves on your immense patriotism to this country. But not only that, congratulate yourself on your matriotism to other human beings in this world. I am so honored to be here when anybody in this world is being oppressed, we are being oppressed. And that's something that we don't understand in this country. We think we have God on our side. And you know, if George Bush talks to God, I don't like that God. I don't like the God that George Bush talks to. I like the God that Jesus talked to. I like the God that told Jesus to say, "Blessed are the peacemakers." I like the God who said, "Thou shalt not kill." And I don't like George Bush's God. I like my own version of God. I like a God who loves everybody, not just white Americans.
As the rain comes down and the final speakers are going up, of course, bands will go up and play, and this crowd is now starting to dwindle. But from Los Angeles, there comes the sounds and the crowds all gathered together with one thought in mind: to stop this war. I hope you've enjoyed parts of what I played for you here on Indirect Democracy. Okay, just have the last sponsor to play from my local cable company, and here is that sponsor. This week on Comedy Central, tune in for Mind of Mencia as Carlos does a show without demeaning stereotypes of Latinos. Only on Comedy Central. Check your local listings for showtimes in your area. Okay, as we always do, we end off this episode with the What a Weenie Award. And this week's What a Weenie Award is actually pretty obvious, but important in its reasoning. For this week, despite a speech filled with the usual blend of domestic and foreign issues that we all expect in any State of the Union, this What a Weenie Award goes to the President, George W. Bush, for not what it said, but for what it failed to say. Now, I'm not talking about asking for a detailed plan for exactly how issues would be paid for or planned for. You know, name me any one State of the Union that was overflowing with the exact details of any plan. But from the beginning of his speech, the President avoided the issue that mattered most, Iraq, bearing it to the last half. Maybe it was for dramatic timing, give him a big finish, but in listening to the same rhetoric about issues he obviously doesn't believe in, such as budget discretion, which of course was disheartening, Iraq needed to be first and not an afterthought. And as to the budget, this president, in discussing earmarks, failed to mention that the Republican Party were the largest contributor to earmarks and that there can be no balanced budget until Iraq is figured into that budget. But I digress. His lack of discussing the Gulf Coast was glaring, but one issue caught me for obvious reasons. For the first time in a State of the Union, this president used the words global climate change. Unfortunately, it was not the use of the term global warming, but it only took this president 6 years to have him utter these words together, global climate change. And at that moment, Bush finally found a Reagan-esque moment. Not to negate the horror of AIDS, but it took Reagan about 7 years to recognize a global scourge that has killed millions. It took 6 years for Bush to recognize a threat to the entire planet. Although he said these words, I recognize that an administration of oil profiteers will never act quickly to use technology that will in the end hurt their profits. He said it, but does he mean it? All of his actions over the past 6 years says he will not. For that reason, in finally taking the time to say global climate change, and then in obviously not wanting to really do anything about it, he is the winner of this week's What a Weenie Award. Hey, speaking of the State of the Union address, and before I end off this episode of Indirect Democracy, did anybody catch that glare that Condoleezza Rice gave during the speech? I've posted it on the websites for Indirect Democracy and the Podomatic site, and hopefully it shows up on your player. But what a scowl! Oh my god! You know, in watching that, I almost figured that the people that created HDTV, the engineers and inventors of that, were somewhere in a corner in the fetal position, sort of crying. I was wondering if they were having that type of Robert Oppenheimer moment where they were just terrified of what their invention had just unleashed upon the globe. I mean, that look was scary. I don't know what was going through her head, but I'm glad that I was not on the receiving end of that look, except for having to be exposed to that vicious growl that she had going on. Very scary. Part of me would love to know what it was that she was thinking at that moment. But as always, I would like to thank Matt Bloodwell and the guys at Megaphone for allowing me to use their song, Not Your Enemy, from the album For Crying Out Loud. You can find their music through www.megaphonemusic.net or through their MySpace account at myspace.com/megaphone. You can also purchase their album through iTunes. I truly appreciate them allowing me to use their song. I really love the song. Earlier today before broadcasting, I was listening to For Crying Out Loud just because I just enjoy the album a whole heck of a lot. I just want to say thanks to them. I really appreciate it. I apologize for this podcast being a little bit longer than usual, but there was a lot to discuss, and I'm glad that you could be part of it. Please tune in next week. We're going to have a lot to talk about with signing statements. But as always, I want to thank you for listening. be sure to take care of yourselves, take care of each other. I will see you very soon. Bye for now. Feeling a little lost without the president's horoscope.